Linton Kwesi Johnson is an accomplished activist and artist. Through his poetry and songs, as well as his work as a journalist and lecturer, Jamaican-born Johnson expresses the frustration of a generation of black immigrants to the UK. Johnson's poems were first published in the London-based newspaper Race Today, which provided Britons with an outlet to discuss racial issues in Thatcher's England. Later, with the help of guitarist and producer Dennis Bovell, Johnson recorded his poems set to the sounds of reggae. To give you a better idea of his poetry, here is Johnson to read one of his early works.
This is a poem called Youth Scene, and I wrote this when I was about 19, and it describes a scene with some rude boys that used to hang out in Brixton on a street corner, guys who I used to go to school with, but they were rude boys. Last Saturday, I never depa no farm, so I decide to take a walk down a Brixton and see Wagwan. The brethren them stand up outside a hip city, as usual, I look pretty. Them a laugh, big laugh, them a talk, dread talk, them a shove and shuffle them feet, swoking in the sweet musical beat. But when night come, policeman run them down, beat them down a grung, kick them ass, send them past justice to prison walls of gloom. But the brother them a skank, them nah a bank, his pocket them a pick, and his woman them a lick, and his run them a run when the wicked come.
Youth Scene by Linton Kwesi Johnson. I ask him how he made the transition from poet to musician.
Most of the poems that I recorded on my reggae albums started life as poems, and then I put them to music. Basically what happened is that I started doing these poems. I was reciting in my local youth clubs, community centers, and that sort of thing. And people kept on telling me that it sounded like music. So I thought, well, maybe it's a good idea to put it to music because more people listen to music than read books. But I'm writing for the eye, and I'm writing for the ear as well. So I was working at Virgin Records when I was a student, trying to earn pocket money by writing sleeve notes for albums, doing biographies of reggae artists and so on. So I put the idea to the people at Virgin that I could do an album. So they gave me £300, and I went and done a demo. And then I met up with Richard Branson, and they liked what they heard, and the rest is history.
The way you use language in these recordings is so different. The patois that you bring to your poetry, was that a result of you wanting them to be read live, or kind of how?
Well,
did that come?
When I began to write verse, it wasn't a quest for poetry. Basically, it was a need for self-expression. I'd read a book by the African-American scholar called W.E.B. Du Bois called The Souls of Black Folk. And that book had such a tremendous impact on me. It moved me and made me want to express how I felt about the experiences of my generation of black youth growing up in England in a kind of a racist environment. So when I began, I started writing in English. But I found that the English language couldn't really adequately express the things I wanted to express. I was writing about a Caribbean experience in Britain, and it seemed to me to make sense to use a Caribbean-based language. So when I began to try to find my own voice, I drew on my own cultural roots, which is Jamaican, using the Jamaican language, the beat of the drum, and the rhythms of reggae music.
I'd love to have you talk a little bit about what you experienced. I'd love to have a contrast of first what your life was like in Jamaica before you came to England, and then what you experienced when you first arrived. Because I'll bet that there, you know, certainly reading W.E.B. Du Bois was important to you, but I'm sure your own experiences had far more in shaping your political views.
Well, I come from a place in Jamaica called Clarendon. It's in middle Jamaica, mountain country. My family were peasants. You know, we lived in a village where there was no running water, there was no street lights or anything like that. We got our drinking water from the river. We bathed in the river. We planted yams, bananas, sweet potatoes, sugarcane, ginger, corn, and so on. And the kids took part in all of that, you know, we helped out. My childhood days were very happy. I was born in 1952, so I was born a British subject. We were still a British colony in those days. My mother and father belonged to that generation for whom small holdings couldn't hold them any longer, so they went to the urban centers in search of work. And I lived with my grandmother. Mm-hmm. And it was the best time of my life. It was me, my sister, and my grandmother. And I was like the man of the yard, you know? My grandmother used to call me her husband. She used to say, go to the shop and buy something for me and be quick, my husband. And when I come back, she'd say, oh, you back already? Oh, I don't know what I would do without you, my husband. God bless you, you know? So, yeah, I had a cool kind of childhood. And then I joined my mother in England in 1963. Of course, we were educated in the British colonial system. You know, we didn't learn anything about ourselves, about our own history, about, you know, our own culture and so on. It was the old colonial education. I'm not going to knock it, because when I went to England, I found that the standard of education that I was getting there was far below anything that I was used to in Jamaica. The standards were much higher in Jamaica. And the school, it was structured in streams. You had three streams. And you'd find that the guys who came from white, unskilled, working class backgrounds would be in the lower streams with the black guys. The guys who came from the semi-skilled backgrounds would be in the middle streams, and the guys who came from sort of middle-class backgrounds would be in the top stream. And in the top stream, you did Latin, Greek, and foreign languages and so on. In the bottom stream, you didn't get a chance to do that.
And what kind of racist attitudes did you face?
Everywhere. You were confronted with hostility everywhere. Dirty looks from people racially abusing you, kids calling you, you know, children can be very cruel. Kids calling you black bastards, calling you monkeys, telling you to go, why don't you go back to your tree that you used to live in, and all kinds of racist abuse. Even the teachers were sometimes abusive. And what was important was that the teachers had low expectations of you. You weren't supposed to aspire to become an engineer or a doctor or a lawyer. You were the children of immigrants, and you were being educated to go and work in the factories just like your parents, or to go and work in the hospitals or on the transport system just like your parents.
What was your experience that led you to get to university?
I'm coming from an immigrant family. You're black, and you know, it was drummed into your head from you were a child in Jamaica that the only way to escape the cycle of poverty was education. So, you know, my generation were driven by ambition to uproot ourselves from that cycle of poverty, and that's how I ended up in university.
Lyndon Kwesi Johnson is our guest today on the World Cafe, and we're talking about some of the experiences that have gone into a wonderful look back at the 25 years of his work, which is on a new live album recorded in Paris. Some of the earliest things that you've done live on here, one of the earliest, I guess, would be Sonny's Letter was a very important piece for you early on. How did this come to be written?
Well, during the 70s, there was a campaign within the black community to get rid of a law that we knew in the black community as the SUS law, SUS being short for suspicion. A significant section of my generation of black youth were criminalized under this law. And under this law, you didn't have to actually commit a crime to find yourself in prison. It was based on suspicion. As long as a police officer was able to convince a magistrate that he had reasonable grounds to believe that you intended to commit the crime, that was all that was required. And you would be convicted of attempting to steal from persons unknown, because there was never any victim there to say, well, this guy tried to pick my pocket or whatever, you know. And that, you know, it gave a police, the unscrupulous and racist police officers, a field day, and they used it mercilessly. I chose the form of a letter. It was a letter poem from prison to a mother somewhere in the Caribbean, trying to explain the circumstances of the imprisonment of the writer.
And this is Sonny's Letter. Thank you.
London, Southwest too, England. Dear Mama, good day. I hope that when these few lines reach you, they may find you in the best of health. Mama, I really don't know how to tell you this, 'cause I did make a solemn promise to take care of little Jim and try my best to look out for him. Mama, I really did try my best, but nonetheless, I'm sorry to tell you, sir, poor little Jim get a rest. It was the middle of the rush hour, when everybody just a hustle and a bustle to go home for them evening shower. Me and Jim stand up waiting for a bus, not causing no fuss, when all of a sudden a police van pull up. Out jump three policemen, all of them carrying baton. Them walk straight up to me and Jim. One of them hold on to Jim, say him taking him in. Jim tell him to let go of him, for him not do nothing, and him not a thief, not even a button. Jim start to wriggle, the police start to giggle. Mama, make I tell you what them do to Jim. Mama, make I tell you what them do to him. Them thump him in him belly and it turn to jelly. Them lick him pan him back and him rib get pop. Them lick him pan him head but it tough like lead. Them kick him in him seed and it started to bleed. Mama, I just couldn't stand up there and do nothing. So me juke one in him eye and him started to cry. Me thump one in him mouth and him started.
Okay, Jay, Linton Kwesi Johnson is our guest, and that is Sonny's Letter, an early piece which is documented and done live with the Dennis Bovell Dub Band on the new recording done in Paris. You know, it's interesting. I've heard you talk about this, that you get more radio airplay outside of England, in other places in Europe than in England. Is that more? I'm assuming that has something to do with the subject matter of your
absolutely.
Work.
The late John Peel, the greatest British broadcaster DJ, was the only person who would really give me any airplay on mainstream radio. I mean, I got played on the little small stations and on the pirate stations, but John Peel was the only one who gave me an airplay. I was seen as being a subversive, someone who was a bad influence on the youth. In fact, some right-wing propaganda had it that I was responsible for an entire generation of lawbreakers and illiterates because of my verse. So that accounts for that, I guess.
Hmm. But you've always had a live audience, it seems, in England and elsewhere, that are just rabid about your work, and that must be. How important is the live aspect of what you do versus the recordings? Because they seem like two.
Well, they complement each other. The live performances and the recordings. In those days, I didn't have a band. I had backing tapes. I used to record my stuff on a Revox, the backing tracks, and do the poems over that.
Mm-hmm.
And I had three guys on stage kind of dancing with me. I started doing these gigs with quite a lot of the new wave and punk bands, because in those days, punk and reggae, there was a kind of a solidarity between the two musics. Reggae was the rebel music of the black youth, and punk was the rebel music of the white youth, you know? So I was doing gigs with Susie and the Banshees. I was doing gigs with Johnny Rotten's band, Public Image Limited, and punk groups like that. I don't think we ever played with a Clash, but you know, those kind of bands. And it was like black and white working class youth solidarity.
You also do a lot of, I was noticing if you go to the LKJ website, you see that there are a number of non-performance things you do. You do a lot of speaking at universities and a number of panels, particularly on black writing, black poetry, Now, how would that differ? I mean, obviously, there's no backing band, but would your performance, what your choose of what poems you choose to do, change it?
Yeah, I mean, I do things when I'm working with the band. I do numbers that I wouldn't call them poems. I would call them lyrics. Like Fight Them Back, for example, which is an anti-fascist number I did during the 70s, which don't work as well on the page, but they work well with music. But apart from that, it's normal. I more or less do the same material, just when I'm doing poetry readings. It's just that there's no band there.
Right. Well, here's kind of an example. We can go from one to the other. And this is a combination that I guess is, you've been doing together for a long time, The Great Insurrection, into Making History. What's the background of these pieces?
Those numbers, those poems, right-wing critics would call them poems celebrating violence, but they're not really. They're poems celebrating resistance against violence to the black community on the part of the police. In 1981, we had a riot in Brixton, which spread through most of the inner cities in England. And what sparked the Brixton riot was a thing called Operation Swamp 81, a police operation, where they just simply went around stopping and searching, harassing and intimidating black people going about their everyday business. And it was like the straw that broke the camel's back. So Making History and The Great Insurrection records, chronicles those events in a celebratory manner.
Them cause such a friction that it bring about a great insurrection, and it spread all over the nation. It was truly an historical occasion. It was event of the year, and I wish I had been there when we run riot all over Brixton. When we mash up plenty police van, when we mash up the wicked one plan, when we mash up the swamp 81, we make the rule of them understand that we not take no more of them oppression. And when me check out the ghetto grapevine, they find out all I could have find. Every rebel just a rebel in them story. Them a talk about the power and the glory. Them a talk about the burning and the looting. Them a talk about the smashing and the grabbing. Them a tell me about the vanquish and the victory. Them said the Babylon them went too far. So what we had was the bun too far. And one and two innocent getting mar. But what? No saw it for some time in a war. In Star, no saw it for some time in a war. Them say we burn down the judge, we put up on the landlord. We burn down the judge, we never burn the landlord. When we run riot all over Brixton, when we mash up plenty police van, when we mash up the wicked one plan, when we mash up the swamp 81. Them say we command their car and we gather ammunition. We build we barricade and the wicked catch afraid. We send out we scout, we go find them where about. Then we farm up, we posse and we make we raid. Now them run gang up and counter action, but the plastic bullet and the water cannon will bring a blam blam. We'll bring a blam blam. Never mind Scar Man. We'll bring a blam blam. Now tell me something, Mr. Government Man. Tell me something. How long you really feel you could keep we on the heel when the truth done reveal about how you grab and steal, about how you make your crooked deal, make your crooked deal, eh? Well, down in Southall, where peach did get fall, the Asians them farm up a human wall against the fascists and them police shield. And them show that the Asians got plenty zeal, got plenty zeal, got plenty zeal. It is no mystery, we're making history. It is no mystery, we're winning victory. It is no mystery, we're making history. It is no mystery, we're winning victory. Now tell me something, Mr. Police Spokesman, tell me something. How long you really think we woulda take your button lick, the jackboot kick, the dirty bag of trick on your racist politics, your racist politics, eh? Well, down in Bristol, they had no pistol.
But them chase your Babylon away. Man, you shoulda see your Babylon, how them really run away. You shoulda see your Babylon them. Pick up that deal, pick up that deal, pick up that deal. It is no mystery, we're making history. It is no mystery, we're winning victory. It is no mystery, we're making history. It is no mystery, we're winning victory. Now tell me something, Mr. Right Wing Man, tell me something. How long you really feel we woulda gravel and squeal when so much murder conceal, when we wound can't heal, when we feel the way we feel, feel the way we feel, eh? Well, there was Toxtet, and there was Masside, and a lot of other places where the police had to hide. Well, there was Brixton, and there was Chapeltown, and a lot of other places that was burned to the ground, burned to the ground, burned to the ground. It is no mystery, we're making history. It is no mystery, we're winning victory. It is no mystery, we're making history. It is no mystery, we're winning victory.
Making History and the Great Insurrection from Lynton Kwesi Johnson, who is our guest today on the World Cafe. And, you know, gathering this together, 25 years of your work, one of the things you can look back on is your popularity continues at this point. But you also look at the events that these a lot of your work talks to, and the incidents of racism that your work talks to. And I'm wondering how you see changes from 25 years ago to now, and has your work had the effect you would have liked it to have?
It's difficult to measure the impact that one's work has had. What I do know is that in terms of poetry, there's a very vibrant poetry scene going on in England right now. Lots of kids are writing poetry. The old slam thing that is influenced by what's going on here, the old hip-hop thing has influenced a lot of kids. And I don't know if there are many Lynton Kwesi Johnson clones around, but kids are writing poetry, and the poetry scene is very vibrant. Things have changed in England. Britain has come to terms with the fact that it is a multiracial, multicultural society. Black people are no longer marginalized as they were when I was a child growing up. People don't no longer, whole families don't no longer live in one room. We have an emerging middle class. We have members of parliament. We have people in local government. Significant number of people have joined the police force, people in the armed services, and so on. So things have changed significantly, but we still have a long way to go in our struggle for racial equality and for social justice.
Lynton Kwesi Johnson, thank you so much for talking with us. I was wondering if you could pick something you'd like to read to go out on?
Okay, I'm going to do a poem I wrote as a consequence of reading something in the Oxford Companion to 20th Century Poetry about dub poetry. And it quoted someone as describing dub poetry as, quote, overcompensation for deprivation, unquote. And I thought, since my name has largely been associated with dub poetry, I couldn't let that go. So by way of riposte, I wrote a piece which refers to Buthelezi, which is Chief Buthelezi of the Zulus, who were collaborators with the apartheid regime in South Africa, and a thorn in Nelson Mandela's, the flesh of Nelson Mandela's ANC. And there's also a reference to Lance Percival, who was a very popular English comic actor, who also made a name for himself doing parodies of well-known calypsos. So this piece, by way of riposte, is called If I Was a Top-Notch Poet. If I was a top-notch poet, like Chris Okigbo, Derek Walcott, or T.S. Eliot, I would write a poem so damn deep that it bittersweet, like a precious memory will make you weep, will make your feeling complete. Like when you love a leave and do a defeat you concede, still you beg and you plead till you win a reprieve and you're ready for rock steady, but the music done already. Still, in the meantime, with me rhythm, with me rhyme, with me rough bass line, with me one sense of time, goon poet of a step in line. Kabuta lazy might have got couple thousand, but Mandela for him thousands of thousands of thousands of thousands. If I was a top-notch poet, like Kamau Brathwaite, Martin Carter, Jane Cortez or Amiri Baraka. I would write a poem so rude and rootsy and subversive that it make the goon poet turn white with envy. Like a candomblé voodoo kumina chant, a whole time calypso or a slave song that get banned. But from granny right down to grand picnic, each and every one can recite that the one. Still, in the meantime, with me rhythm, with me rhyme, with me rough bass line, with me own sense of time, goon poet have a step in line. Kabuta lazy might have got couple thousand, but Mandela fee him thousands of thousands of thousands of thousands. If I was a top-notch poet, like Chikaya Yutamsi, Nicholas Gulen, or Lorna Goodison, I would write a poem so beautiful that it's simple. Like a plain girl with good brains and nice ways, with a sexy disposition and plenty compassion, with a sweet smile and a subtle style. Still, me nah go bow and scrape and go on like a ape, peddling no puerile parchment of ethnicity, with ungla vague fleeting hint of authenticity. Like a black Lance Percival in reverse, or even worse, a babbling buffoon who lose him tongue. No, sir, not at all. Me got me rhythm, me got me rhyme, me got me rough bass line, me got me own sense of time. Goon poet of a step in line. Kabuta lazy might have got couple thousand, but Mandela fee him thousands of thousands of thousands of thousands. That's from my book, My Revolutionary Friend, published by Penguin in their Modern Classic series.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
LKJ, Linton Kwesi Johnson, the first in a series of archived interviews for Black History Month. Next week, Cassandra Wilson talks about returning to her home in Mississippi to record. Coming up, it's Bob Marley on the World Cafe.